Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
The alteration of day and night here, وَلَهُ اخْتِلَافُ اللَّيْلِ وَالنَّهَارِ, and unto him belongs the alteration of night and the day, might be telling us that one of them takes the place of the other. Of course, it can also mean that they have gradual lengthening and contraction, which result in the four seasons of the year and are important factors in the life of the human beings and, of course, other creations like the plants. These factors all serve to guide us to knowing and thanking the Almighty Allah. And that is why, at the end of the verse, it says, أَفَلَا تَعْقِلُونَ? Have you then no sense? So, throughout the last three verses we discussed, two of the most important principles were understood. The first was resurrection, and the second is monotheism, that is achieved through contemplation and specifically reflection upon the fact that life and death are both at the Almighty Allah's will. Brothers and sisters, in the next program, we will touch upon some of the traditions on the intellect and we will move on to the next verses. Thank you for staying with us. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry, in your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me. Why ends when faith begins?
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. And we are discussing these some phrases from the sermon number 147, which has got certain prophecies regarding the future of the Muslim community and the Islamic Ummah and what will be those dangers that it is facing. And in the previous session, we discussed one of those prophecies that Imam Ali alayhi salam mentions, and that is, وَلَا أَكْثَرَ مِنَ الْكَذِبِ عَلَى اللَّهِ وَرَسُولِهِ. And he says that there will be nothing more common than lying upon Allah and the Holy Prophet. That means people will spread lies regarding God. They'll spread wrong notions about who God is. And also they will spread wrong ideas about the Messenger of God. And just like, as you know, today there are people who claim to be Muslims, who claim to be believers of God, but they have interpolated and changed the statements of God and also of the prophets and the messengers, and especially the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. There are books that have so much blasphemy and wrongness that clearly contradict the beautiful and wonderful character of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And this is something that Imam Ali alayhi salam says will be common in the final days, and therefore it is important for us to take the necessary precautions from earlier on so that we can be safe.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, today we'll discuss about another prophecy that Imam Ali alayhi salam mentions in Nahjul Balagha, and that is that he says, وَلَيْسَ عِنْدَ أَهْلِ ذَلِكَ الزَّمَانِ سِلْعَةٌ أَبْوَرَ مِنَ الْكِتَابِ إِذَا تُلِيَ حَقَّ تِلَاوَتِهِ. He says that there will be nothing more valueless. There will be no commodity that has more little value than the book of God, which is read in the right way, which is recited in the right way. That means the most valueless, the most unwanted or undemanded, commodity or entity, you can say, or issue that will be there on those times will be the book of God. But what book of God? That book of God which is read and it is recited in the right way, in the correct way, in the deserving way. That will be the most unwanted commodity ever in that time. And that means that, here Imam Ali alayhi salam is pointing out a very important fact, and that is that the holy book, when it is recited, that is the Holy Quran, when it is recited, there are two types of recitation. The first type of recitation is a good recitation, is a correct recitation. It is a deserving recitation. While the second one is the bad recitation, or the undeserving recitation, or the wrong recitation. Imam Ali alayhi salam says that that which will lack value, that which will be unwanted and disliked, which will be undemanded, whereby people will not show interest in it, is the book of God that is recited in the right way. But on the other hand, the book of God which is recited in the wrong way, of course, there will be much demand for it. People will be listening. People will be wanting that. And that is one of the signs of the end of days.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, as we said in the previous segment, that Imam Ali alayhi salam says the most unwanted commodity in that age of the final days will be the book of God which is recited correctly, which is recited in the right way, in the deserving manner. While the one which will be probably wanted by people will like it, will be that type of Quran, that type of recitation of the Quran, which is not very good, which is bad in fact, which is not deserving. What do we mean by that? The deserving and the correct type of recitation of the Holy Quran is that one which is in conformity with the soul of the religion. While the bad type of recitation of the Quran and the, you can say, the undeserving type of recitation of the Quran is that one which is empty of the soul of religion. Which is there is a form of recitation, but doesn't have the soul of the religion. And what is the soul of religion? The soul of religion is awareness, is enlightenment, is recognition, is movement, is struggle, is direction, okay? It's revolution. This is the soul of religion. Now, if there is a type of recitation that lacks the soul of religion, that means it is one which is conforming or which is concomitant to wastefulness, which is concomitant to, time, just resting and lack of progress and lack of growth and lack of enlightenment, then that is not the right type of recitation. So, for instance, there are certain people who recite and read the Quran, but they just pay attention to the way they recite, that means the voice and the methods of recitation and the way to stop, the way to continue, where to recite in a high pitch, where to change the tune, where to use a certain type of tone. If the whole discussion is based of the Quran is based on this type of recitation, then that is not the most, and then that is not the one that is encouraged in Islam. Inshallah, in the next session we will discuss about what is the right type of recitation and why Imam is saying that on that end of times this will be very much very much of a disliked commodity. Inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
The membership has happened. After holding the observer state status since the year 2005, Iran has become a permanent member of the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. What will that mean for the bloc, and will this bloc, with Iran's addition, stand up to the West, in particular when it comes to trade and security? Hi, I'm Kavit Ahwai. Coming up in today's program, the SCO, a regional organization in the heart of Asia, whose members account for 1/5 of the global GDP, 2/5 of the world's population, and 3/5 of the Eurasian landmass. Now, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, on his first maiden foreign trip, was welcomed with SCO membership. Not a bad start. Countering sanctions and increasing trade now more likely for the country. Also coming up in this program, does the SCO now spell a concern for the U.S. That is something the U.S. needs to think of. Is this the end of U.S. unilateralism? Now that CO has Iran, China, and Russia on its list, all targeted by the U.S. through sanctions and maximum pressure policy, has the U.S.-China containment received a blow?
A regional organization in the heart of Asia, whose members account for one-fifth of the global GDP, two-fifths of the world's population, and three-fifths of the Eurasian landmass. Such is the combined value of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization's nine full members: China, India, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Pakistan, Russia, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and now Iran.
Iran, Saeed Ibrahim Raisi.
The group did have four observers: Mongolia, Afghanistan, Belarus, and Iran, but Iran is no longer part of that grouping. And the SCO has started procedures to admit Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Qatar as new dialogue partners. Given the enormous extent of geographical coverage, amounting to 35 million square kilometers, and a population as high as 3.15 billion people, the organization has been known to be the greatest producer and the greatest consumer of energy at the same time on a global scale. Over its 20-year existence, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization has been mostly seen as a forum for security cooperation to combat extremism, separatism, and terrorism. But now trade and banking are more dominant concerns. China and other members of the SCO have made considerable economic and commercial progress in the last 20 years. Annual trade volume has increased by 20 times in 2020. A favorable environment for trade and investments, and achieving free flow of goods, capitals, services, and technologies, especially in the post-era of the COVID-19 pandemic, has become more of a priority issue. These have all been stipulated in the organization's charter.
The process of expansion for the SCO was a natural outcome for the organization, waiting to happen. But this occurred years ago, and it appears more nations will follow. Russia and China are the economic powerhouses of the SCO. Some achievements of that organization is that its total GDP reached $16.6 trillion in the year 2017, while approaching EU's $17.1 trillion and accounting for almost 25%, close to 21% actually, of global GDP. Well, the SCO is expected to surpass the U.S. in the year 2022. And by 2022, China's total economy will be around $15 trillion, and the proportion of SCO's economies will reach about 26%. So that says quite a lot. Well, joining us for this segment, we have André Loing. He is an international and independent China strategist. He's had decades of experience as a senior Hong Kong government official in a variety of fields, including finance, industry, social welfare, and overseas representation. André, welcome. The SCO countries, some of the stats, covering one-fourth of the Earth's land and nearly half of the human population, a regional organization in the heart of Asia, members accounting for one-fifth of the global GDP, two-fifths of the world's population, and three-fifths of Eurasian landmass. What is the economic capacity of this organization, and has it reached its full potential?
Well, of course, in the organization, the role of China and the economic size of China overshadows everything else. Don't forget that in a different organization called the BRICS, China, Brazil, Russia, and India, China's economy is the sum total, is bigger than the sum total of the rest combined. As you rightly pointed out, the organization has been pushing below its weight. But I think the time has come for the organization to adopt a much larger role with the change in Afghanistan.
Okay, thank you for that. We appreciate it, André. Let's now take a look at more information about the SCO. It's a lot that encompasses this grouping of countries, and the next piece will enlighten you on that.
We'll be right back.
It's time now for our info news section of the program. This is where we try to focus on economic news and social news that usually don't make it into mainstream media. Now, our first story occurs in the UK. The headline read, UK empty shelves, a crisis that isn't just down to COVID-19 and Brexit. It's been decades in the making. Now, that's something that many perhaps are not aware of. It went on to say that ever worsening conditions in supply chain jobs have made Britain's shortages inevitable, and a pay rise for lorry drivers won't end them. Now, you combine that with a labor crisis, you bet the UK is worried. Next up, we'll go to the US. 9 million Americans just got the rug pulled out from under them when enhanced pandemic federal unemployment benefits expired there. Now, workers in this country aren't lacking work ethics. They're saying they simply don't have reliable child care, health care, or economic infrastructure to support them in times of crises. Now, while this has happened, COVID-19 is still raging on in that country. So pulling the benefits from these Americans is not coming at a good time. Moving on to China, officially applying to the Asia-Pacific Free Trade Pact, the CPTPP was joined that, and it inked it in 2018. You had 11 countries, including Australia, Canada, Chile, Japan, and New Zealand, that joined it, which in the accord represent nearly 500 million consumers, accounting for 13.3% of the global GDP. Now, the trade agreement is essentially an updated version of the ill-fated Trans-Pacific Partnership, if you remember that. Finally, we go to Sri Lanka. A state of emergency declared there. There's an economic slump. There are food shortages in that country, so bad that the military was deployed to stop the citizens hoarding food amidst shortages of essential goods. The prices of food, including rice, milk, and cereals, have tripled in some areas due to inflation, while many shelves in the government-run supermarkets in the capital, Colombo, are empty. This is our in-depth section where we take a deeper look at today's topic, SCO's economic perspective. Now, in order to get an idea about where the SCO stands compared to the rest of the world, that's our main focus now, let us take a look at this map. Now, this map here is a breakdown of the SCO in terms of the ones that are members, which is in red, the ones who are observers, that's in orange, and the ones who are attendants, they call it attendants. And you can see those members, which are comprised in those three categories. China, India, and Russia, for example, are three of the major members. Of course, Iran, as you can see over here, Iran now is a permanent member, something that obviously is a milestone, because Iran had the observer status since the year 2005. Now, the ones remaining in that grouping are Mongolia, Afghanistan, and Belarus. Also noteworthy is to talk about the dialogue partners, which Turkey is in that grouping. And then, more importantly, you have another development. SCO has started procedures to admit Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Qatar as new dialogue partners. So it's noteworthy to mention that here. Now, our guest Andre Long talked about the China Belt and Road Initiative. Take a look at this. It's good to have your memories refreshed if you haven't taken a look at this. This is basically the China's Belt and Road Initiative, which represents Chinese President Xi Jinping's grand vision, which obviously starts from China, for example. And you have the breakdown in the colors. Black are the land routes that from China goes all the way through and is a gateway covering countries like Pakistan, like Iran, all the way through to Turkey, and it's a gateway to Europe. And then you have the maritime networks, which start again from China, for example, from Fuzhou port there in the green. These are all the different ports that it encompasses in this Belt and Road Initiative. Again, Iran being one of the major connecting points between the Far East and then into going into Europe. So you can see how that regional integration is what's important. It increases trade, and it stimulates economic growth. Okay, now the Polar Silk Road, usually not mentioned in the Silk Road Initiative by China. This is the Polar Silk Road, this one area in the black, which goes around all the way through on top of Russia, which leads onto Europe. So you can see this is very important. Again, something that's not mentioned is called the Polar Silk Roads. And again, the Belt and Road Initiative, important because it's a gateway to Europe. and beyond. And these are the others that we just covered in the previous map, which are the maritime routes and, of course, the land routes. So I want to now shock you with an old map. The world divided in half. You got the western side, and then you have the eastern side. The eastern side comprised of Africa, for example, West Asia, and Asia. It was the center of global trade in terms of economic activity. Gives you an idea about the way that the trade volume in the past was focused in this area and in this region of the world. Now, these facts cannot be ignored. We're going to talk about now the facts about the SCO in terms of what it comprises. Over 60% of the world's land mass covers the SCO countries cover, and this is a leading institution that says that. More than one-third of the world's population, again, a very important fact, to give you a depth about the SCO. Also, we need to mention how it has nearly 45% of the world's energy reserves. Again, very important. And also, it's a combined economy that nearly equals the U.S. gross domestic product. So the SCO, when you take a look at those figures, has significant influence over the world's economy and security. Moreover, the SCO is an organization exclusive of the U.S., which may potentially threaten U.S.'s security and interests. So this question can't be ignored. Shouldn't the U.S. be concerned by the SCO? Now, for a breakdown, professor and political analyst with an economic flair, Mohammad Mirandi, joins us. He's a lecturer at the University of Tehran, and he's appeared on numerous media outlets, such as Al Jazeera, such as RT, and also we can mention TRT World. And he joins us now to give us his insight and analysis on this. Professor Mirandi, welcome. The SCO meeting this year has admitted Iran finally. And this admission, you tweeted that Iran's membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is another major setback for the U.S. regime. It shows that the U.S. did not have enough influence to convince a single government to block Iran's entry. It's also good news for all of Iran's allies. Can or does the SCO, now Iran has joined it, have the ability to stand up to the West? And will the SCO be able to economically, through trade, stand up to the West?
Well, SCO countries collectively are more powerful than Western countries. And as the balance of power tilts away from Western countries, I think Asia will become even more powerful, comparatively speaking, than today in the near future. The United States and its allies have antagonized Iran, Russia, China, and other countries. They are the ones who've created so many adversaries for themselves because they want to be the hegemon over global affairs. And now that they've done this, now that they've antagonized so many countries, this has created an enormous incentive for countries that are constantly being attacked by the United States to cooperate more than before. So three important countries, China, Russia, and Iran, which have confronted American imperial ambitions and have been on the receiving end of U.S. hostility, they are moving closer together, and the SCO provides an opportunity to even strengthen that convergence even further.
The 21st meeting of the Council of Heads of State of the SCO has been held in Tajikistan. This year marked the 20th anniversary of the organization's founding. The Chinese President Xi Jinping called on member states of the SCO to strengthen solidarity and cooperation and build a closer SCO community with a shared future. Iran was finally approved as a member in his first trip overseas. Ebrahim Raisi welcomed Iran's admission, said that diplomacy is one of the means to ensure national interests of the countries.
Diplomacy is one of the means to ensure national interests of countries. It is efficient when all sides remain committed to their obligations in practice. Threatening and pressuring other sides weaken diplomacy.
When it comes to Iran's membership at the SCO, this comes at a crucial time due to the JCPOA and Iran nuclear talks. Iran's president has said that Iran's economy and economic progress will not be tied to the outcome of the talks if it did not yield the desired results for Iran.
The world is entering a new era with a new order. domination and unilateralism are on the decline. International order is moving toward multipolarization and redistribution of power in favor of independent states.
Iran has said that the best solution would be to find intra-regional banking and monetary mechanism to help independent countries deflect illegal U.S. sanctions and pave the way for securing free trade by taking advantage of national currencies or by defining a specific currency as a suitable alternative for the U.S. dollar, something that SCO members are doing.
The SCO economies, as explained, make up a major portion of the world economy. But the world economy itself, after the pandemic, is changing in terms of which countries are contributing the most to economic output. Now, SCO as a whole makes up around 25% of the world's economic output. And as countries like China, Russia, and India, and even Iran progress economically, which are projected to be the case, the economic output of the East will then eventually outpace the West, in particular the EU and the US. Now, let's not forget that Qatar and Saudi Arabia are also being considered for joining the organization, which will expand the organization and world GDP as a consequence. Now, both of our guests rejoin us for this final Q&A of the program, Professor Mohamed Marandi. We also have Andre Luong, international and independent China strategist, rejoining us. Professor Marandi, I'm going to first start with you. The SCO countries, in terms of the relevance, in terms of the stats, some of them, one-fourth of the Earth's land, half of the human population. It's a regional organization in the heart of Asia. And in terms of the global GDP, accounting for one-fifth of that. We're looking at Iran to have joined it, a host of countries now, amongst them Russia and China, as you're well aware. Do you think that the economic potential of the SCO has been reached, especially now that Iran has joined it?
Iran's membership in this organization creates an important opportunity for Iran to expand its trade and business and cooperation, both political and economic, with Asian countries. We know that Western countries are on the decline, and the rise of Asia is visible for everyone to see. Iran is critical in West Asia. It is the most important power in Western Asia, so it can contribute a great deal to the integration of the continent as a whole. But also, these countries like China, Russia, and other members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization can help Iran as well to decrease the capabilities to put pressure on Iran. So all these countries need one another, and as Asia rises and as Western countries decline, this is an important and historic moment.
Okay, Andrew Luong, let me turn to you. This is an important point that I'd like to make. In 2017, you had India and Pakistan becoming the official members. Iran is now a member, and the primary goal of this group is to reduce the risk of conflict between SCO member states. At least that was one of their charters. Joining the fight against the three evils, terrorism, extremism, and separation. But you also have this China One Belt project, which connects these countries, but the U.S. is on a confrontational path with China. Is the U.S. then a threat to these countries and their ambitious economic goals?
Well, I don't think the United States has the appetite or the resources to build as big connectivity projects like the Belt and Road. As far as don't forget that India is part of the SCO members, and India and China do not see eye to eye always. But nevertheless, it's a member of the SCO, and India is not a total ally of the United States either because of this nuanced, non-aligned foreign policy.
Andre Luong speaking there, international independent China strategist, and also like to thank Professor and political analyst Mohamed Marandi, who gave us his
thoughts and input into this program on the SCO. At this point, I'll be back in our next segment with my final thoughts. There's no denying it. The SCO is now a relevant organization in the world, from trade to security, i.e. fighting extremists and terrorists, especially when it comes to a country like Afghanistan. Now, this block of countries stands smack on the face of the U.S., which wants to pursue China economically and militarily. Countries that are in China's sphere, who have been aided through loans for the execution of China's Belt and Road Initiative, especially countries that have been hit by harsh U.S. sanctions like Iran, will stand in the way of U.S. unilateralism. There are even talks of establishing a new monetary system to bypass the Western-controlled SWIFT banking system, like between Russia and Iran. That does it for this edition of the program. Your questions and comments are always welcome. It was great to have you with us. From Mika Vitava, the entire team, it's goodbye.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. Among the cases that we look at when it comes to humanity or the rights of human beings is the corruption aspect of things. And we mentioned before that we said corruption has a lot of negative impacts on society, on the economical level, on the political level, and also on the social level. So we are looking at some of the social effects, the bad effects, obviously, that corruption leaves on humanity. Among those effects, corruption leads to the concentration of wealth in the hands of few in society and deprives the rest of their financial resources, deprives them of their share of support. When a system or a government or what have you, or even globally, when the wealth is going to only few, a handful of few, like, for example, 1% or 5% of a country own the wealth of the rest of the country, so you could automatically tell there's a problem. So the majority of the wealth is going to the few, and the rest of the people, they are getting nothing. They're working day and night to bring table to their food, to their families, and deprives them of their livelihood. They don't get to spend quality time with their families. They don't get to do anything because the man, and sometimes even in many countries now, both male and female are working. Kids are at school or kindergarten or childcare. And you see that society itself is corrupted, is broken, is weakened because only few, handful of people own everything, while the rest of the people are suffering and, you know, they're trying to, each day, trying to survive day by day, or as we use the term, paycheck by paycheck, because they've got too much expenses to pay and so on and so forth. So when corruption happens, this concentration of wealth will happen as well. Why? Because obviously the hierarchy of things, if you look at the hierarchy of power, you see that those who are in power, they just don't care about what people have or how they live. For example, compare that to the life of Imam Ali alayhi salam when he was the head of the state and the treasury. He would every day he would divide whatever in it equally amongst people, and then he sweeps the floor, and then he just sits and he says, "I hope there's no one hungry in Yemen," for example. Where others, for example, who were before him and after him, they used to hog, if we use that term, and take all the wealth of the people and divide it amongst themselves, and they give it to their families, for example, or to their friends or to those who support them, and the rest of the people get nothing. And you can see people in the streets being hungry, people have nothing to do, they're jobless, people who cannot afford to support their families, and obviously that itself, poverty itself, leads to many crimes. As Amir al-Mu'mineen says himself, he says, if poverty was a person, I would have killed it. Because when a person has nothing to live on, obviously he would think of committing either a haram or committing a crime. Or, for example, a mother who has kids and she wants to support them, but she can't bring them food. She is forced, for example, to do a lot of haram, a lot of sins, a lot of crimes in order to feed her children. So when wealth is concentrated in the hands of few, it will surely deprive the rest of the people. It will deprive the rest of the people that live in such a system or a government or what have you, of their fundamental basic rights and their share and their portion of the wealth that was meant to go to them, but actually someone else is taking it because of the notion of corruption. Let us take a break and then we continue, inshallah.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to IRIB English Radio and listening to the program For Humanity. Amongst the effects of corruption that it leaves on the society, it will increase the power of the wealthy, obviously, because now they're wealthy, and we, as we know, with wealth, power comes, right? Those who are wealthy are those who have power because they can afford to buy power. They can afford to buy the manpower, the weapon power, and whatever power is in between. They can even enslave people because obviously they have the wealth. So it increases the power of the wealthy and widens the gap between the classes. So then we have a higher class, a wealthy class, and we have a lower class. The more that gap increases, you know, the more corruption happens in society as a whole. Because there are people who are poor looking at those who are in power, who are wealthy and powerful, and then you have this hate, you have, you know, everything happens in between. I don't want to go into the details of things. So it has that negative effect, and the poor themselves, they have nothing to survive on, and society itself breaks down, and you see even corruption happens. Sometimes, because we live in a very, let's say, civilized world from the outside, but when you take each country aside and you break it and you go deep inside it, you will see how bad people are suffering. Even in the most famous countries that, you know, the world looks at, for example, take America. People think, oh, America is a land of dreams where dreams come true. But in reality, if you look at the statistics, and you see how much millions of people are suffering, millions and millions, more than half of the population are suffering. They can't afford to pay rent, they can't afford to buy things for themselves, clothes, food, and so on and so forth. And for example, in a lot of, even take California, for example, a state that people look at and, you know, admire. I've been told, and I read the statistics, that the rate of poverty is extremely high, where people living under bridges, people living in the streets. And why is that? Because those who are in power, those who are wealthy, they have the upper hand, they have the power through wealth, and it created that gap and created that class between them and the common people and the rest of the people. So their rights are taken from them. So corruption leads to that kind of effect on society, especially if it is from a political side of things. Like if the corruption was happening politically, right? We know, like, some countries, they have states, and each state would have their own laws, and whoever is in power take the rights of those who are poor. Then we have this problem happening. We'll leave it up to here, and inshallah we will continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صلي يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Limit.
After days of controversy, the U.S. House of Representatives has passed a $1 billion bill to fund Israel's so-called Iron Dome missile system. American lawmakers approved the bill in a 420-9 vote on Thursday. The push had appeared in a bill on Tuesday aimed at providing emergency funding to the U.S. government to avoid a shutdown, but was later removed without explanation. The removal was attributed to opposition from a small group of Democrats who demand the U.S. support for Israel be based on the regime's human rights record. The exclusion of the provision, however, drew strong reactions from Republicans and pro-Israeli Democrats, with Republican Senator Lindsey Graham calling the move despicable.
The progressive movement in Congress consists of maybe, less than 10% of the Congress. So they have very little power. And furthermore, the progressives in Congress don't often use their power. They're intimidated a lot of times into going along with the rest of it. So we can't expect very much from the progressives.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett thanked both parties in the House for their support, adding that those who tried to challenge the U.S. support for Israel got a resounding response. The bill is now heading to the Senate, where it's highly likely to be approved, as American politicians from both political camps have traditionally backed Israel. It's also expected to be signed into law by President Joe Biden, who has already signaled support for the additional aid. Pro-Israel American lawmakers have been pushing for additional funds to Israel to replenish the regime's missile system since the most recent war on Gaza ended in a ceasefire earlier this year. The truce stopped the 11-day conflict in May, the most intense fighting between Palestinian resistance groups and Israel in years. Palestinians have hailed their victory in the battle, citing the show of force to the Israeli regime by launching over 4,000 rockets and scores of drones to combat the enemy. The sheer scale of the attacks overwhelmed Israel's so-called Iron Dome anti-missile system. The war killed over 250 Palestinians, including 66 children in Gaza and 12 people in Israel. That's a significant number, considering the regime's heavy expenditure on anti-missile systems, while the resistance in the impoverished and besieged Gaza Strip has no means of shooting down Israel's missiles.
From the point of view of justice, there's no reason not for Palestinians not to have an Iron Dome system. But obviously, that's not what Israel wants at all. Israel wants to be able to hit Palestinians, to cause misery and destruction and death to Palestinians. Whenever they feel like it.
The move by Washington to increase aid to Israel comes despite calls by some U.S. politicians and activists to cut fundings to pressure the regime into respecting Palestinians' rights. With all that said, the reversal of the move to include the additional aid to Israel in the U.S. government spending budget suggests that Washington's unwavering support for the regime is beginning to falter, as no U.S. lawmaker would hesitate to approve more funding for Israel a few years ago.
Thousands of Yemenis have taken to the streets to mark the 7th anniversary of the September 21 revolution against the Saudi-backed regime in Sana'a. Participants in the rally chanted slogans against foreign aggression while carrying the country's tricolor flag and pictures of top resistance leaders. They also denounced the criminal complicity of Western powers and the Israeli regime in the Saudi-backed aggression and war-ravaged Yemen. The demonstrators vowed to uphold their revolutionary ideals and not surrender to the foreign powers. They said the popular revolution had thwarted the conspiracy to divide Yemen through resistance to foreign aggression and hegemony.
Yemeni people are working hard to liberate themselves from the tutelage and occupation. It is known to the world that the occupation does not last, and no matter how long it remains, it will eventually depart.
In 2014, the people of Yemen led a popular uprising against the Saudi-backed unpopular regime of Abdel Rabbo Mansour Hadi. As protests gripped the country, the Antara resistance movement on September 21 took control of the capital Sana'a, following a rapid advance south from their northern stronghold of Sada'a. The massively popular protests were against the incompetent and corrupt regime in Sana'a, backed by Riyadh and directed by the U.S. In a bid to crush the resistance and reinstall the Hadi regime, the Saudi-led coalition launched a ferocious bombing campaign on the neighboring Arab country barely 6 months later.
I think at this present time, the Saudis are willing to keep this thing going. Even if they can't win, they'll keep it going so as to not be pointed at and said they lost. How long they can do this is, I don't know, but I think that's our present situation.
The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement says the U.S. was in charge of administering his country's internal affairs prior to the popular revolution against former Yemeni President Abd Rabbah Mansour Hadi, better known as the September 21 Revolution. He highlighted that Washington used to conduct Yemen's affairs before the September 21 Revolution, and the U.S. Embassy in Sana'a had the upper hand over the presidential office. The Ansarullah leader went on to say that the U.S. used al-Qaeda terrorists to create division within Yemen and to advance its hegemonic agenda, stressing that Washington also sought to influence Yemen's educational system in favor of the Israeli regime.
The Saudis and the UAE are influenced by the U.S., as is the U.S. influenced by them. They are dependent often on U.S. weapons, of which they are major purchasers, and that makes us dependent on them. But they are not controlled by Washington.
He added that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are just pawns in the hands of the U.S. and are cows being milked by Washington to serve the Tel Aviv regime's interests. Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S. and regional allies, launched the war in Yemen in March 2015 with the goal of bringing Hadi's government back to power and crushing Ansarullah.
I don't think that the Saudis can win. Under present circumstances. And I think the support, whatever they got out of Trump, is probably less now, relatively speaking, under Biden. But there's this other factor, and the factor is that the Saudi government and the head of the Saudi government doesn't want to lose face. Now, you and I might be able to accept losing face under certain circumstances, but they don't believe that they ever want to lose face.
The war has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and displaced millions more. It has also destroyed Yemen's infrastructure and spread famine and infectious diseases. The Yemeni armed forces and allied popular committees, however, have grown steadily in strength against the Saudi-led invaders, leaving Riyadh and its allies bogged down in the country. Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, has addressed the 76th session of the United Nations General Assembly via video conference. It was his first address to the main policy-making organ of the world body since taking office last month. During his speech, Raisi said the U.S. efforts to impose hegemony on other countries have, quote, failed miserably, and that Washington's hegemonic system lacks credibility. Raisi said Washington is using sanctions as a new way of war against other nations, stressing that the U.S. sanctions against the Islamic Republic during the coronavirus pandemic are crimes against humanity. This year, two scenes made history. One was on January 6, when U.S. Congress was attacked by the people, and two, when the people of Afghanistan were dropped down from the U.S. planes in August, from the capital to Kabul. One clear message was sent to the world. U.S.'s hegemonic systems has no credibility, whether inside or outside the country. He describes sanctions as the U.S.'s new way of war with the world countries.
Raisi represents the anti-imperialist current of the Iranian population that is fed up with sanctions. For years, the U.S. has been imposing brutal sanctions that have devastated Iran's economy, killed families, working class families of Iran who are unable to access medicine, infrastructure, because of sanctions. And the goal all along with the U.S. was to impose sanctions, blame it on the policies of the Iranian government, make it seem